Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Prison Justice Show. Last time we talked about language. It was a bit of an odd discussion because, you know, talking about the way we talk about things is always a bit of a mind-bender. We began by talking about the nomenclature that the incarcerated or ex-incarcerated prefer for themselves. We found that certain groups preferred certain terms. Those in power, wardens, guards, etc., preferred words like inmate. Overwhelmingly. There were some, obviously, people not in power mixed in with that group, but this is just the broad things that we found last time. So anyways, people in power preferred words like inmate, while those who weren't exactly in power, like the incarcerated, ex-incarcerated, activists, etc., they preferred terms like incarcerated individual, or just words like prisoner, or being called like an incarcerated person. And they noted that words like inmate had been specifically used to intimidate and dehumanize them. We also talked about the accusatory implications behind the words themselves. For example, you know, there's the way that calling someone imprisoned for murder a murderer or inmate implies in a way that they deserve to be there, you know, that they were guilty of their crime. You don't really go around calling people in prison for murder, you know, like maybe accused murderers or convicted murderer, but maybe there's something that happened in the trial. You know, it's just the idea that when you say this word, you kind of imply that, no, they deserve to be there, that they were guilty, that everything, that the justice system proceeded as intended. All those other things are things that you kind of smuggle in with your assumptions when you use words like murder, for example. Furthermore, we looked at how these terms come to define people long after their incarceration, even though they really shouldn't. For example, here there's the idea that we think of people as ex-felons at all, you know, creating a class of people called ex-felons, when realistically, after serving their time and going through rehabilitation in prison, you know, we should just consider their debt to society paid. We shouldn't really set them apart as a class of people for this experience that they had or for this conviction that they had. If you take the mindset that prison's there for rehabilitation in the first place, which I think most people would agree with. Finally, we looked at the subconscious implications of certain descriptors and compared them to common ones. So how do we feel about the words mother, father, brother, sister, etc., versus prisoner, inmate? And the fact that we use words like prisoner, inmate, and whatever, and we have all these assumptions about these words, despite the fact that the incarcerated are, you know, mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters themselves, you know, they are people just in the same way that everyone's a person. And there's the idea that using certain language to describe them has an impact on its own, because that language itself carries a host of implications itself, and it reinforces those implications. For example, there, if society and media tells you that an inmate is some evil, scary murderer who deserves to be in prison, then even if you reject those implications, right, you say, well, I don't think that's necessarily true. As long as you continue to use that word, you reinforce those implications nonetheless, because even if you personally think, oh, well, this isn't true, if you keep using this word that everyone else is told is true, then all of, like, media tells you is true, it puts that message still back out into the world. Now, today, we're going to talk about language again, but through a bit of a different lens. Instead of talking about how the general public refer to the incarcerated and the prison system, we're going to look at prison language, which is the complex and interesting language that is created behind bars to begin with. Slang is a universal concept in general. You know, we all know specific local terms that we grew up with that would be confusing to other people. You know, slang's often used to establish yourself as part of a group or to explain phenomena in a more specific or loaded way, which is necessary to your situation or, you know, just for flavor. Incarceration is a setting that can produce this language quite easily, as it spreads easily as well, given the dense social network and captive audience, as one PBS article puts it. So, before we get into specifically the language of prisons, I actually found a cool thing which was boosted by the Prison Studies Project that gives four basic guidelines to follow. So there are four steps. These are from Eddie Ellis, who was a former Black Panther Party member who was framed for murder by the FBI in 1969 as part of the infamous and nefarious COINTELPRO operation, and who spent 25 years in prison himself as a result of this accusation. So to begin with, I'll read his open letter on language and its importance, and then we'll continue on to the four rules he gives at the end based off it. All right. So again, this was Eddie Ellis. So he says, one of the first initiatives is to respond to the negative public perception about our population as expressed in the language and concepts used to describe us. When we are not called mad dogs, animals, predators, offenders, and other derogatory terms, we are referred to as inmates, convicts, prisoners, and felons. All terms devoid of humanness, which identify us as things rather than as people. These terms are accepted as the official language of the media, law enforcement, prison industrial complex, and public policy agencies. However, they are no longer acceptable for us, and we are asking people to stop using them. In an effort to assist our transition from prison to our communities as responsible citizens and to create a more positive human image of ourselves, we are asking everyone to stop using these negative terms and to simply refer to us as people. People currently or formerly incarcerated, people on parole, people recently released from prison, people in prison, people with criminal convictions, but people. We habitually underestimate the power of language. The Bible says, "Death and life are in the power of the tongue." In fact, all of the faith traditions recognize the power of words and, in particular, names that we are given or give ourselves. Ancient traditions consider the naming ceremony one of the most important rites of passage. Your name indicated not only who you were and where you belonged, but also who you could be. The worst part of repeatedly hearing your negative definition of me is that I begin to believe it myself. For as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. It follows, then, that calling me inmate, convict, prisoner, felon, or offender indicates a lack of understanding of who I am, but more importantly, what I can be. I can be and am much more than an ex-con, or an ex-offender, or an ex-felon. We believe that if we can get progressive publications, organizations, and individuals like you to stop using the old offensive language and simply refer to us as people, we will have achieved a significant step forward in our life-giving struggle to be recognized as the human beings we are. We have made our mistakes, yes, but we have also paid or are paying our debts to society. We believe we have the right to be called by a name we choose rather than one someone else decides to use. We think that by insisting on being called people, we reaffirm our right to be recognized as human beings, not animals, inmates, prisoners, or offenders. We also firmly believe that if we cannot persuade you to refer to us and think of us as people, then all our other efforts at reform and change are seriously compromised. Accordingly, please talk with your friends and colleagues about this initiative. If you agree with our approach, encourage others to join us. Use positive language in your writing, speeches, publications, websites, and literature. When you hear people using the negative language, gently and respectfully correct them and explain why such language is hurting us. Kindly circulate this letter on your various listservs. And thus he gives four easy steps to follow. First is be conscious of the language you use. Remember that each time you speak, you convey powerful word picture images. The second is to stop using the terms offender, felon, prisoner, inmate, and convict. The third is to substitute the words people and returning citizens for other negative terms. And the fourth is encourage your family, friends, and colleagues to use positive language in their speech, writing, publications, and electronic communications. So going forward, I intend to do the same myself. I've actually used such language many times before, but I'm going to try and substitute it thusly going forward. In some cases, it's going to be unavoidable. For example, in given the mission statement of an advocacy group, a lot of the time I'm quoting them directly, even though I might forget to say the word quote. A lot of the time when I say they're an advocacy group based on doing this or based on doing that, I'm reading straight off their mission statement. Or it might be unavoidable when describing an initiative or a group of people plainly. Like if people refer themselves as a group of ex-prisoners or ex-inmates, I don't really intend to change their language for them because they're using the language that they find comfortable. But I think that in any other case, it's important for me to shape my language positively nevertheless. In other cases, I probably will just definitely slip up myself, but I'll try to catch myself when I do, and please do call me out if I do so. Just as a note, still from last time, if you remember, I do want to note that a significant portion of incarcerated or formerly incarcerated people, they still do prefer the word prisoner, as per last episode. So this word was noted in the list, in the letter, to not use. So I'm going to still try to avoid that going forward. But this is just to say that if people do use the word prisoner or something, there is like a pretty substantial group of people that prefer that term. But I think it's interesting that a lot of the stuff we talked about last time are kind of present in this letter, right? It's the general idea here is the fact that language forms the foundations of the way that we think and act and everything. So when he says this statement, the fact that if we can't persuade people to refer to us and think of us as people through our language, then all other efforts at reform and change are compromised. I think that's put plainly, just kind of talking about the power of language there, you know, about how it's so important that if we can't get the language right, or at least change it to some significant degree, then pretty much all other efforts at reform and everything are going to go to waste because people aren't thinking about the incarcerated as people at all. But so with all that having been said, and kind of as a neat little wrap-up of what we talked about last time, now let's get into the language of prisons themselves. So to begin with, let's talk about why slang exists in the first place. Professor Feldman of Boston University says this: slang fulfills at least two functions. One, for groups that use it, it's a way to set themselves apart, to express themselves in a distinct way, and sometimes to keep secrets. And two, for society in general, slang is a laboratory where new words and forms can be tested and then abandoned or incorporated into regular language. If slang allows people to say something that cannot be said using traditional language, and a majority of people accept them, these words and expressions join the regular language. I think that prison slang is formed for roughly the same reasons, especially in the former category, right? That's that it's created for groups that use it as a way to set themselves apart, express themselves in that distinct way, and to keep secrets. As noted in a 2019 PBS article by Elizabeth Flock, there was a person named Randy Kearse, who was a formerly incarcerated person, and they published a book in 2006 full of words and phrases that he had learned while he was in prison. The book was filled with around 10,000 entries. Actually, originally, when he was writing the book, or conceiving of the book, he thought that he might get like 1,000 tops, but what he ended up with was, you know, around 10,000 entries, much higher than he initially thought. And actually, other dictionaries and estimates have had like up to 20,000 entries, things like that. So my point here is that this is a pretty like big set of words. It's not just like 10 or 20 things that people in prison say that people on the outside don't really say. This is its own language. Kearse said that slang was primarily created to fool the guards, or at least to prevent them from knowing what the incarcerated were talking about. Now, you can take this one of two ways, right? So first, if you take a cynical view, you could think that things were being planned to hurt guards or to weaken prison security, right? Any kind of, like, number of nefarious deeds. But the reality was often the other one, you know, the non-cynical one. It's just that prisoners just wanted some privacy to talk about things. It's a privacy that's notoriously hard to come by in a situation with constant surveillance like prison. Kearse actually noted this himself when he saw that guards were paranoid about Spanish-speaking incarcerated people. So while guards thought that when they're speaking Spanish they were planning drug deals or other dangerous affairs, in actuality they were usually just talking about completely mundane everyday things. Kearse actually notes affairs coming up like their sister's wedding, you know, new music albums coming out, things that they were excited about. And in the world of prison, where eyes and ears are everywhere waiting for you to slip up, you know, in the system that seems wholly designed to antagonize you, this privacy is key to feeling human. You know, you're having a conversation about just normal everyday things, and you're having this conversation and not exactly being monitored. In the example of Spanish-speaking people, it's the fact that the guards couldn't understand what they were saying. It makes you feel human, the fact that you're, it makes you feel like you're not under constant surveillance for at least this one small part. Sometimes, though, this privacy is more than just for mundane affairs. Sometimes it is used for serious things. That's not to say that it's always used for nefarious things. For example, the culture of violence towards the incarcerated is unfortunately nothing new. You know, you have from experiments on authority, such as the Stanford Prison Experiment, to real-life examples of officers violently mistreating the incarcerated, it's been shown repeatedly that the incarcerated will be abused by the system that holds them captive in some way or another. Bruce Riley is a formerly incarcerated person who is now deputy director of an advocacy group. He actually notes his own one thing that actually happened to him, which is that he had rules and regulations for getting simple things be patently oppressive. These are things like magazines and soup that he was looking to get. At one point, he actually notes that he was thrown into solitary himself for bringing soup for a fellow incarcerated individual. So you can have a situation where, let's say, like your fellow is hungry, right? And you want to bring him soup or something, and let's say you even like plan on stealing it or bring it to him against the rules. Well, this isn't exactly a nefarious thing that you're doing, right? You just have a fellow person that's hungry and you want to bring them food. So even if it's against the rules, you can use something like this language to plan these things out so that the guards might not be able to tell what you're gonna do or hear your plans, and you can smuggle that food out to them. And the fact that it's against the rules doesn't, just because it's against the rules, doesn't exactly make it evil or bad. So, I mean, I'm just saying that's an example where that is a serious affair, but it's not exactly a nefarious affair. But prison slang is used for other things as well. It's also like a useful outlet for creativity. It's not just for super serious things or super mundane things. For example, both Riley and Curse said that they felt that prison language was an extension of hip hop. Actually, Curse's book to begin with wasn't called Prison Slang or anything. I believe it was called Hip Hop and Urban Slanguage, even though it was based on words that he picked up while he was in prison. There are actually a lot of shared words between hip hop and prison slang, as well as the general idea of creativity in terms of phrases and rhymes. For example, many slang terms rhyme with their actual meaning. The article gives the example of, well, this is from the 70s, but the word Ripsy Rousers was slang for the word trousers in a Washington state penitentiary. And again, this is like the 70s, so the words have definitely changed since then, but it's an example of the fact that people don't kind of just throw out any word and say, all right, this word is good to mean that thing. It is still like a way to be creative, you know, change your language in a way that you think enhances the things that you're saying. Other terms are just interesting. You know, ear hustle means eavesdropping, for example, and that, you know, kind of makes sense. It's something to do with your ear, and it's like a hustle. You know, you're not supposed to be there or doing something you're not supposed to in some cases. It's eavesdropping. The creation of a language, you know, full of rhyme, rhythm, and meaning is a way for the incarcerated to express themselves on some level. And it's born of a willingness to create, to produce, you know, something brilliant, even in the conditions that you might find yourself in if you are incarcerated. Another interesting aspect of prison slang, then, is that it emphasizes and gives extra meaning to certain parts of prison life. So again, remember that this can be used as a creative outlet. Well, creativity often isn't used just for creativity's sake. Creativity is often used to give meaning to things. So, for example, if we talk about solitary confinement, which you've heard me say pretty much a million times is inhumane and has been defined as being pretty much torture if you have someone in solitary confinement for more than 15 days, things like that. I think it's defined as torture or war crime or something. Either way, it's bad. Well, anyways, in prison slang, it's called things like the hole or the dungeon or the box and so on. These phrases reflect the sentiment and conditions surrounding solitary confinement. You know, from such words, there's imagery of a dark, closed-off place, for example. These aren't exactly words that describe a punishment that can easily be shrugged off. You know, you can just imagine yourself stuck in a hole or a box. You know, imagine the claustrophobic nature of the scenario. Imagine the fear you would feel. Imagine like the darkness and everything. Well, let's take another word or phrase from the word dungeon. Think of the fact that you aren't allowed visitors many times, you know, that it feels like torture. You know, the word itself is reminiscent of barbaric medieval punishments in general. You know, nobody thinks of a person in a dungeon and thinks that they're having a swell time. And all these things really tell you how people feel about solitary confinement. It tells you about what the experience is actually like. But again, you know, slang isn't always used for particularly severe things. Per some examples from the law library, you take phrases like rapos, which is a term for the incarcerated who annoy their fellows by constantly telling them that they were wrongfully convicted, or hooch for alcohol made in prison. Other terms aren't particularly politically correct, obviously, or nice, like crazies or dings to refer to mentally disturbed individuals, but they're still useful information as to how people are perceived in prison, while these terms not being particularly harsh either. Prison slang is also adopted as a way to show that you belong and that you have solidarity within a group. To intentionally use a language separate from the guards and inclusive to the incarcerated shows your allegiance in a way. You know, by using terms like snitch or rat for someone that cooperates with officials or prison informers, it's made clear that these people are not part of the in-group, that the snitches and rats aren't part of the same group. that those who take the side of the guards are rodents and that they should be exterminated. This is particularly violent imagery, to be sure, but it's the reality of the situation. And again, this doesn't mean that everyone that uses such terms actually wants the people to be killed. The point is that, at the very least, the terms help to define who shows solidarity, who is part of the in-group, and who is not. It also notes the sentiment towards such people and acts to discourage such behavior. It kind of, the language reinforces the way that your in-group works, the way that people behave. It's these unwritten rules. And in a situation as dangerous as prison can be, that's extremely pertinent information, because whether or not you disagree with what these terms mean, it's still pretty much the rules that a lot of people will have to play by. And if you're someone who is in prison and who doesn't know these unwritten rules, learning the language or just hearing the language and copying it is a good way to get a hold of these rules. And in that vein, you know, furthermore, adopting such terms gives people an easy way to fit in as well. For a newcomer, or in slang in prison, a fish, like a fish out of water, learning the culture and unwritten rules of whatever prison they're in is a daunting task. But copying the language of those around you is a relatively trivial task, and is a fast way to feel like you're part of the group, and to make the group accept you as well. This isn't just a prison thing, either. You know, if you're someone that speaks in a southern dialect, you'll be more accepted around people that speak the same dialect. If you're around people that say y'all all the time, for example, you'll start to say it as well. And you'll start to identify more with that group, and they'll identify more with you as a result. The idea behind that being, well, I talk like them, so I'm like them myself, and the opposite being true, which is this person talks like us, so he's probably like us as well. And I'm sure that most people can think of a word or phrase like that, you know, maybe not specifically y'all, but you know, just something that you picked up when you were part of a certain group, maybe with certain friends, but they don't use as much with others. Maybe it's a dialect that you learned growing up but lost as you moved somewhere else. Maybe it's just an accent that you gained or lost somewhere along the way. Maybe it's just a word or phrase that some friend that you made and some area of the country said a bunch, and then you moved away and you stopped saying it, but, you know, you have an example of something like that. And you probably never made some big concerted effort to pick these things up. Picking these words or phrases up was probably trivial for you as well. Is something that you just happened to gain by contact. Well, I think prison slang just happens to fit the same mold. It's not some big, daunting thing that people need to learn when they go in. Although there have actually, as a side note, been a lot of dictionaries and help books published for people to understand prison dialects. Some are actually geared towards people who are scared of the experience and going for the first time and want to learn these terms. But the point is that it's really not that much different from the language that you learn just moving somewhere similar in the country. You'll pick up a lot of the meanings, all the words and phrases, just by usage or just by observing other people. Again, like, it's not like someone said y'all to you and you asked him, oh my god, what does that mean? You know, like, you probably just picked it up from context clues at a certain point. And finally, I also just want to say that prison slang probably gives the incarcerated something that is their own. And I think that's a really powerful thing for it to give. You know, so many things are out of your control when you're in prison or when you're incarcerated. Your schedule is controlled, your clothing is controlled, your recreation is controlled, and so on. There are so many limitations on what you can do or how you can live, but one thing that you can control, you know, one thing that you can have to yourself, to some extent at least, is your language. Prison slang gives you outlets for creativity, it gives you privacy, it gives you solidarity, but more than anything, it gives you something that is yours, not theirs. It's a reminder that regardless of your situation, there's still things under your control, and ways for you to exert yourself in whatever environment you're in. Well, with that having been said, we'll have that be our show to today. Thank you for listening, as always. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, feel free to email prisonjusticeshow@gmail.com.